Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. I'm Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Steve Holmes, a GP in Somerset and Education Lead with the Primary Care Respiratory Society. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Sally.
Today we're discussing the recent COPD module, which is based on last year's NICE guidance. Let's just recap. How do you think about COPD?
Sort of areas we should be thinking about are people who are smokers, who present with persistent coughs, especially recurrent coughs, who have symptoms of productive phlegm on a number of occasions, and usually over the age of 35.
So it's mostly smokers and mostly over 35. Any other groups we should think about?
And about 80 to 90% of patients, there is a very convincing smoking history that correlates quite well. I think the other thing is watching out for the symptoms of people with coughs and colds coming in on a recurring basis. Oh, I just need some more antibiotics for my bronchitis, doctor.
So there's a sort of cultural understanding of bronchitis, which for us is often what we would think of as COPD.
Yes, certainly some of the work that was done a few years ago in primary care suggested that 5 or 6 presentations with, inverted commas, bronchitis occurred before the diagnosis was made in primary care. What I hope now is that we're much more in tune with the suggestion of a smoker coming in with a chesty cough that doesn't seem to be settling down, and we push patients in towards having spirometry and other investigations at an earlier stage. Test-wise, I think the first thing is let's make sure we get a decent history. Look out for evidence of reversibility. Could this be potentially asthma? Look out for symptoms of weight loss with a cough, hemoptysis, anorexia, other features that might actually suggest this is carcinoma rather than COPD. Looking out for other symptoms of fatigue rather than breathlessness, palpitations, etc., and certainly make sure we do a good clinical examination. The symptoms of breathlessness are quite common in patients with atrial fibrillation, with heart failure, with aortic stenosis. And so we shouldn't just think either respiratory causes when we see people presenting to us with symptoms of breathlessness. With cough, again, we're thinking pneumonia. We're sometimes thinking things like pulmonary emboli, pleural effusions, and reflux esophagitis. So there are a variety of other symptoms that should go through our mind and differential diagnoses when we're doing our examination before we get on to tests. Test-wise, NICE hasn't changed its advice. If we're thinking about COPD, we should, one, do a chest x-ray, which will help to exclude other potential pathologies like carcinoma of the lung, pneumonias or other unexpected findings. Two, we should do a full blood count to exclude anemia and other abnormalities hematologically. And the third thing that NICE put in along with that was to measure a body mass index. And I guess that makes us think of the contribution that weight makes to somebody's element of breathlessness. So it's chest x-ray, full blood count, body mass index, and then we should confirm the diagnosis, if the pattern fits, with good quality spirometry.
Sometimes things happen the other way around and we just get an incidental finding on a chest x-ray report of emphysema. What do we do with that?
I think there are two areas we find like that. The first is, as you say, a report that says emphysema on the chest x-ray or hyperinflation of the chest. That does not help us to make a diagnosis. Indeed, it's about as good as a clinical guess that this might be COPD. So we need to go through the basic clinical examination, good history, and progress to doing proper spirometry to confirm the diagnosis. The second area is emphysema reported on a CT scan. And many of our patients now presenting as emergencies or if there's a suspicion of a tumour, get quite an extensive CT scan to check for other abnormalities. It won't be uncommon to find emphysema on the scan. Again, probably the sensible thing there is, number one, history examination. Number two, do the symptoms fit in with genuine emphysema? Can I confirm an obstructive picture on spirometry? And NICE guidelines did actually suggest if emphysema is fairly minimal on a CT scan and there are no other features of COPD and spirometry is normal, that we don't need to progress further. But clearly, if there are symptoms, that would warrant a specialist referral.
Once we've got to a diagnosis, how do we assess severity?
NICE suggests classifying the severity on two basic parameters. One is symptoms, and two is the extent of exacerbations. That combines with two other parameters that Rupert Jones, an academic general practitioner from Plymouth, identified and published very nicely, which is the level of obstruction. Measuring an FEV1 in this group will put people into mild, moderate, severe and very severe categories. And the other area of great importance in looking at the severity or the likely prognosis of COPD is smoking status. Clearly, with smoking, we should be trying to provide brief advice to help our patients to stop.
So much COPD is managed in the community by us and our nursing teams, particularly. Who needs referral?
I suspect there are two or three areas of key referral. I think number one is where we're not sure ourselves of the diagnosis. The picture doesn't quite fit properly. The second area that should ring alarm bells to us as clinicians is if the person is unusually young. People who develop COPD at a very young age, we would be thinking about an alpha-1 antitrypsin level, a test that can be easily done on a blood test in primary care and acted on if it's abnormal. But the other key area is a considerable number of people who are smoking other substance other than tobacco. So the illegal drugs that are around appear to be much more likely to cause COPD in the younger age group. And they again should be referred. People who are very young with fairly extensive disease, we might even be thinking about lung transplantation or lung volume reduction surgery. And sometimes when we see patients over a period of time and we're not getting a response as we would expect to the level of treatment that we've got, that would be suitable for a specialist referral as well.
When it comes to management, it's easy to get caught up in the ever-changing colourful inhalers. But we must remember that the most effective interventions remain smoking cessation, vaccination against flu and pneumonia, and pulmonary rehab. Is there anything new on those fronts?
I think there's probably two or three things that are just worthwhile talking about with that. First of all, with smoking cessation, really good help on the National Centre for Smoking Cessation and Training, where you can get very brief advice training, how to help your patient to stop smoking using an evidence-based method that takes 20 to 30 seconds and works far better than having a 4 or 5 minute rant with our patient who smokes. So smoking cessation, keep it brief. We haven't got a lot of time in primary care, and make it effective to try and get our patients on side. Effectively, what we're trying to do is point them into a position where they can get professional support and pharmacotherapy to help them to stop, because that's where the best evidence base is. Number two, flu and pneumococcal vaccination. Yes, a fundamental cornerstone of prevention of disease. The pneumococcal vaccination only once, the flu on an annual basis, and the evidence behind that hasn't changed a great deal. I think the third and probably the most underrated and underused resource is pulmonary rehabilitation, where both NICE and a lot of the Cochrane reviews demonstrate benefits both symptomatically and in reducing exacerbations and improving quality of life. Yet we still don't get enough people pushed through the system and into pulmonary rehabilitation to make a big difference to many people's lives.
I quite often find pulmonary rehabilitation is the thing I have to really sell to patients.
We miss a few opportunities, especially just after an exacerbation. It's a shame that everybody who has an exacerbation, certainly if they're seen in hospital, aren't automatically referred, although I know my colleagues are trying to improve on that. I think telling people they're going on an exercise program can be quite alarming if a lot of their symptoms are breathlessness. And so that has to be carefully phrased in terms of it being a structured, personalised program to help them to become better and to answer their fears about that. Yes, I think once you send two or three people who come back and say, brilliant, no, that was one of the most important courses I've ever done, it helps us as clinicians to understand that and helps us to send the message.
Moving on to inhalers, what's new in the world of inhaled therapies?
I guess there's two areas that stand out. The first is that we now have triple therapy, i.e. a long-acting muscarinic, a long-acting beta agonist, and an inhaled corticosteroid, all in the same inhaler. And there are two available for those at the moment, one a dry powder device and one a pressure meter dose inhaler, which you can also use with a spacer if you need to. So that gives us some options if we want to put a 3-in-1 type inhaler. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we've obviously had what has been called dual bronchodilation, long-acting muscarinics and long-acting beta agonists together. And there are 4 of those, 3 dry powder devices and 1 pressure meter dose inhaler. And NICE guidance, interestingly, has suggested quite strongly that if the patient has anything more than fairly minor symptoms, that we consider using dual bronchodilation. That is a LAMA and LABA for patients where there's no evidence of asthma, but there is good evidence of COPD. That's a little bit controversial. The reason why they're doing that is very specific to the UK compared to some other guidelines, and that's because using both bronchodilators, you get better results in the symptom improvement in the bronchodilation and in exacerbation reduction for a marginally increased cost. In some other countries, the cost differentials are different. And that's why the UK is quite unique in saying LAMA and LABA early on. The other thing that NICE has differentiated out now in terms of inhaler treatment is if the patient has any evidence of asthma in the past, we should make sure they stay on an inhaled corticosteroid. So that'd be an inhaled corticosteroid and a long-acting beta agonist usually to help to bronchodilate. And the other area that NICE talks about in that sort of group is people where it sounds as though there may be significant reversibility. So we possibly get that with quite wide variations in peak flows or FEV1, so we do those in the practice. A change on the spirometry, not enough to suggest this is normal, but to suggest there's a reasonable reversibility, or a high eosinophil count, which we can see looking back into their notes. I think the other thing that NICE has been talking through a little bit at the moment is the impact of inhalers on the environment.
That's an interesting point. Years ago, we moved to CFC-free inhalers, but there are still things in them that are causing damage. Is that right?
The NHS Sustainability Unit has moved on to this in quite a significant way after a variety of discussions. We have now moved to other chemicals, often in some of the pressure meter dose inhalers, but they too have an environmental impact. And it is suggested that of the NHS's total carbon footprint, about 4% of that is inhalers. Now, that's quite incredible when you think about all the transport that goes on in the NHS to and from hospital, both workers and patients going in and out, but that the innocent inhaler that's going around at the moment is having such a big impact. And that's why the NHS Sustainability Unit has been trying to provide patient aids, which are available online, to help people to make decisions and, where possible, and the patient can use them effectively, think about using dry powder devices, which have a much lower environmental impact. I think some of the quotes are around 19 times less environmental impact than some of the pressure meter dose inhalers.
Worth thinking about. I know there was a process of recycling inhalers as well.
Yes, around the country, you should be able to take every inhaler in and they should be recycled. I'm not quite sure at the moment the robustness of how much of the inhaler is recycled in that environment. But certainly, I think it would be really good if we can start to recommend that our patients take all their inhalers back to the pharmacist for recycling where possible.
Are there any particular resources you find good for teaching patients to use inhalers?
The best one around at the moment, I think, would be the Right Breathe website, which I know some of my nurse colleagues who are very keen on respiratory have on their desktop and even as an app on their phone, but is available for both clinicians to have a look at how to use every single inhaler device, but also is available for our patients to have a look at as well. Similarly, Asthma UK has a good website that covers the mainly asthma inhalers. Obviously, there's some overlap there, and that can be another resource. At the moment, it's very difficult for clinicians to remember all the different devices. The last time I looked, there were 117 different devices and doses available, which would challenge even the most respiratory interested of us.
Absolutely. I quite often use the Asthma UK little videos with patients, and they're a great resource. You can also send the patient the link. Now we're increasingly texting patients things. It's a really good teaching opportunity, isn't it?
I think the importance of inhaler device shouldn't be underestimated. It's very much like learning a skill. One of the most important things is a clinician who's competent observing the patient and helping to coach them to do it better. it's sometimes very easy to watch, for example, somebody play a piece of music on a piano on the internet, but that doesn't mean you can play it yourself at home. And even if somebody demonstrates it to you, it still takes coaching and support and teaching on how to use it. And that's where we as clinicians are still vital to make sure that our patients can actually use their inhalers.
Thinking about exacerbations, what's the advice? How do we manage those?
The nice advice is now becoming much clearer and is aligned to other global advice and Cochrane reviews. We do know that exacerbations in the first 6 to 8 hours, often patients can use a short-acting beta agonist, and quite often those symptoms will settle down. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be an extensive exacerbation. The other little clinical tip is, if I see a patient or I get a call from a patient who says, I've had a flare-up for 2 hours, it's terrible, that doesn't sound like a normal COPD exacerbation. That, to me, can often be something like a community-acquired pneumonia, which requires admission, or atrial fibrillation or some other cause. So that requires clinical assessment. The typical exacerbation will usually progressively increase over a period of 1 or 2 days. And most people would suggest that if they've had symptoms for more than 1 to 2 days, that's where we add in our steroids and antibiotics. Steroids, 30 milligrams prednisolone for 5 to 7 days, 5 probably being as good as 7, appears to be what virtually all the guidance is saying at the moment. Antibiotics, amoxicillin, 500 milligrams 3 times a day for 5 to 7 days, fits in with what virtually everybody's saying as well. And a lot of the trials of these have been done in hospitals where you might assume the patient is more severely ill than when they are managed in the community. And the 5-day courses are as good as longer courses. So that's been probably one of the more significant changes, and it's reducing patient steroid load, and it's reducing the impact on their microbiome, on the organisms that are around in the lung and elsewhere in their body, and hence hopefully reducing the exacerbation frequency thereafter.
Towards the end of people's lives, when do you think about a palliative care referral for these patients?
I think this is one of those sort of questions that there are lots of different answers to. I think often we should be trying to be positive about an early diagnosis of COPD and get people to engage in smoking cessation, activity, 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 benefit from the use of inhalers and do the best they can, because we know that many of those patients will retain their lung function as it is for many years if they're not exacerbating. So first thing is, let's get positive. The second thing to think about is symptom control. A lot of patients, if they are feeling breathless, can feel very anxious with that and be part of a vicious cycle. And some of the palliative care teams, the symptom control teams and physiotherapists and talking therapists can make a dramatic difference to help people's breathlessness by teaching them and reassuring them that elements of breathlessness are not going to be something that makes them drown. So addressing that symptom control can be quite important. I think the third level is where we get into the discussions when the disease is very advanced and severe, and the patient has perhaps been in hospital a few times, and they are starting to evaluate where they would like to move in the future, where we can start to plan, if required, care at home with or without palliative care support, symptom control in that sort of environment. And that is something that should be part of a discussion that is planned with our patients. The complexity is that cancer has a fairly predictable deterioration as the disease progresses. However, things like cardiac failure and COPD, and to the same extent dementia, that prognosis is less clear cut, and patients can often be very poorly for a period of time, recover from that, and then go on to survive with a reasonable quality of life several months afterwards.
So was there anything that really stood out for you in this new guidance?
I think the things that stood out for me were, once more, reiterating the importance of a good diagnosis. Once more, reiterating the importance of non-pharmacological therapies, flu, smoking cessation, pulmonary rehabilitation, encouraging activity wherever we can and getting people engaged back in the community. And I think NICE have succinctly summarised the current evidence out there on how to both bronchodilate maximally, make sure that our patients have the best opportunity they can have to be able to walk around as much as they can. It seems rather bizarre that we say, well, we're going to give you a bit of bronchodilation. We're going to make your lungs a bit better, but not as much as we possibly can. See how you get on with that and then come back, knowing full well that we could actually make their bronchodilation, their ability to exercise more, better. So NICE is quite good. Long-acting muscarinic and long-acting beta-agonist together. I think the value and importance of inhaled corticosteroids is also quite well made in this, where patients are continuing to have exacerbations, and certainly inhaled corticosteroids where we think there is an asthma component.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.